warning. The Catholic Man Show contains high levels of manliness. If you think you may be too weak to withstand the manliness represented in the following program, please do yourself a favor and stop listening now. If you choose to continue in spite of this warning, if at any time you feel yourself overcome by the manliness, stop immediately and consult your closest medical professional. And now, for the not so fair, faint, or frilly, we present The Catholic Man Show.
Welcome to the Catholic Man Show. We are on the Lord's team, the winning side, so raise your glass. I am Adam Minahan, sitting here in studio with my co-host, partner in crime, best friend, David Niles. I need to come up with a different name for you. Like, I always describe you as my co-host,
I mean,
partner in crime.
David Niles is pretty good. It's worked.
It's okay.
Pretty well for me so far.
Welcome to the Catholic Man Show. We have an exciting episode today. We're going to do several firsts, which we love doing on the Catholic Man Show.
Yeah, we like to memorialize our firsts.
Yes, we do. Today we have author, apologist, well-known speaker, debater from Catholic Answers, Mr. Trent Horn. Trent, I appreciate you carving out just a little time to spend with us this evening in your busy schedule.
Oh yeah, no problem. I'm glad to be here.
It's going to be a lot of fun. So if this is your first time listening to the Catholic Man Show, we do three things every episode. And it's really interesting, Dave, because I heard I went to the Midwest Family Conference this last weekend.
Yeah.
In Wichita, Kansas. Got a chance. Actually, Trent, I got a chance to talk to your boss, Mr. Tim Staples. Lot of fun. In fact, a feather in your cap or his cap, I guess. But he said, as I was talking to him at dinner, he said that you and Carlo were his two best hires of all time. So that's saying quite a bit.
Well, yeah, except for that one time we thought we could teach a Jack Russell Terrier to be an apologist. So if all the other hires were like that, it doesn't say a lot about us. But no, that's very encouraging. So
turns out. Those are the only two people he's ever hired.
Ever hired in his whole life.
Right, the best hires ever.
But I did talk to quite a few people about the Catholic Man Show, and there are people, I got some interesting feedback. So the three things that we do on the Catholic Man Show every episode is the first thing we do is we open, review, and enjoy a man beverage. The second thing we do is we highlight a man gear. And the third thing we do is we have a manly topic. The most manly discussion of all time. Dave, I looked at our rankings, and once again, this podcast, we won the most manly podcast this week.
What is it, like 60 weeks in a row?
60 weeks in a row.
Yep.
We're the only ones on the board, Trent, but we went ahead and won.
Turns out we're the people who give that award out. So
it's going to be really sad if you ever lose. So.
That's true. So if there's some, we always talk about moderation and the virtue of temperance. In this first segment, because we do have a manly beverage, we do drink on air, and so if drinking is not something that is not part of your lifestyle, is something you realize that it's not something Dave, we talk all the time about self mastery.
Right.
You have to
yeah.
know your weaknesses, and you have to know who you are, and you have to be able to avoid the temptation of sin at all costs. And sometimes temperance for men. Mean none at all.
Yeah. In fact, recently we had somebody asking about joining the Council of Man, mm-hmm. who was kind of concerned that maybe this is going to be a temptation for me because, he's reached the point where he has to live sober.
Right.
So
if that is something that you struggle with or that's something that is in your life, you can always skip to the second segment or the third segment because that's when we talk about the gear and the topic.
Sure. Yeah.
So. Anyway, Trent, this man drink that we're going to have, this manly beverage, is your favorite. We're going to be enjoying a nice rum and Coke.
Yeah, it's when I'm out and about, I mean, I don't drink a lot, honestly, it's just because I'm too cheap to drink, really. But when I do, for a for a special occasion. I like if I'm out at a nice place or whatnot to get a rum and coke because I like pop, and it has a nice kind of smooth, relaxing texture to it. So I guess thank you for drinking in honor of one of my favorites.
Absolutely. Yeah.
In fact, it's one of we've only done a few mixed drinks on the show. Anyway, typically, Trent, we do either like a scotch or or some kind of bourbon, or maybe a craft beer of some sort. We've done a couple of gin and tonics. We actually had a friend who, a listener of the show, who shipped us something, a gin from Ireland.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was really good.
It was really good. So anyway, but Trent, you know, one of the reasons why we started the Catholic Man Show is Dave and I started, we were a part of a men's group called the Pint, Pipe, and Cross group. And it was men getting together, you know, enjoying a beverage and opening the Bible and just fellowship with other men. And I think that that's super important because authentic masculinity and authentic masculine friendship or male friendship is something that is very desired in this day and age and has been so perverted that it's very hard for guys to know, you know, what is a true friendship. What are your thoughts on that, Trent?
Yeah, no, I think that it's really unfortunate just in our day and age that especially, to be frank, with propaganda and stuff coming out of Hollywood and entertainment from those who are pro-homosexual conduct, they can do things where any hint of guys showing care, concern, bonding with one another gets immediately sexualized. And then it creates just this weird rift or feeling, and then guys feel like you can't have any kind of a connection with a fellow man without someone trying to sexualize or make that weird. And it's like, no, guys can have deep and abiding friendships, and they should, and that's important to support one another in their different vocations. And I'm definitely in favor of healthy friendships among all people. So yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and I think, you know, back to the drink, having a drink with somebody, it's kind of like sharing a meal.
Yeah.
You know, there's like a, I've heard it said you don't really know someone until you share a meal with them, and I think you could equally apply that to having a drink with somebody. I don't know what it is about consuming things with somebody else that builds a bond. I'm sure there's like a deep theology of the body essay to be written here. I'm not.
You are what you eat.
Yes.
Yeah. There it is.
Yes. So, but there's just something about having a drink together and even smoking a cigar together. I mean, these are just unique things, unique activities among the scope of human activity that stand out as bond-building things. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the reasons why we do it on the show. Also, we just also really like it.
There's nothing wrong with that. I've also heard for bonding among men, that women bond face-to-face and men bond side-to-side. And that would go back to the conjecture is in our prehistoric days, women spent their time picking berries, sitting in a circle facing one another. Men spent their time hunting game. So they did a lot of things in activity where they were side by side and bonded, engaged in one thing. And I think men need that something that they're doing to share and commiserate with one another for that bonding. So, yeah, definitely. Huh.
That's a cool thing. I mean, it's totally sexist of you to say that, Trent. But that is also very cool.
He's obviously joking, Trent. I don't know. Like, I know you haven't listened to our show, you're sarcastic.
It's all right. You're not the first person to say I'm a sexist misogynist, so don't worry. It rolls off my back by now.
Yeah. So I am curious real quick. We don't have very much time left here, but I'm curious. Do you have any men's groups or like, you know, do you guys, Carlo, when we had Carlo Broussard on our show recently, he was talking about gym time with Tim Staples, meaning like, is the gym open? He would send out an email basically sparring back and forth with apologetics. But do you have a men's group that you get with or a kind of a ritual, I guess, of men getting together?
You know, I have not worked that into my schedule as much as I should, and I really would like to. Myself, most of the men I know we end up being consumed a lot with work and then family. I have two children under the age of three at home. But one thing I do like to do that I go out with men and one of the wives that accompanies us, because, you know, we still try to be open and inclusive. But one activity that I personally enjoy to go out with a group of men is to go to a pub, but especially to do pub trivia. You know, go and live the life of the mind, have a drink and talk. And who knows, maybe one of these days I'll start some kind of Catholic pub trivia somewhere.
Trivia is one of those things that I think I'm good at. And then whenever I do it, I realize I'm the worst. Like, I'm literally, of the people in the group I'm with, I'm the worst one. I'm the weak link here. But I can't get over this idea in my head that I'm good at trivia. I think it's because most of the stuff I know is trivial. And so, therefore, I must be good at it, right? But no,
that's not
it doesn't
case.
Work that
it's
way.
It's good for your humility, though, Dave.
It's incredibly good for my humility. Not that my humility needs it.
I have to do pub trivia because if I went to the gym with Carlo and Tim, I would embarrass myself. So,
the
only bars I can lift are of the candy variety.
Well, Trent, this last Monday, I actually heard you on Catholic Answers talking about doing, like, bodybuilding. And you said something about, like, well, I'm more finessed at building the spiritual than the physical body or something.
I can build a physical body up. It's just going to be small and a little dilapidated.
Oh, man. That's awesome. So when we get back, we're going to be jumping into the man gear. We're here with Mr. Trent Horn. I'm Adam Manhan, sitting here with David Niles. Dave, we're on the Lord's team.
The winning side.
So raise your glass. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Catholic Man Show. I'm David Niles, in studio today, with my main man, Adam Minahan. Also, joined by one of my admitted idols of Catholic radio, Mr. Trent Horn. Trent, I'm not kidding. Like, seriously, I remember whenever I first started listening to you, I actually said this out loud to myself in the car. This is embarrassing, but I don't care. I said, it's like, that's what Jesus would say whenever you said something, because you just kept coming up with really good questions that made the other person realize, yeah, you know what? You're right.
My position is wrong.
Right. And it's just like, man, because, you know, in the Bible, Jesus is always,
that's what we're going to be talking about.
He always does this to people. He just lays down this bomb question, which makes you realize, I'm a total fool. So, anyway, Trent, it really is cool to have you on the show, man.
Thank you. Well, it's easy to sound like Jesus, because when I'm on the radio, I just keep a small Bible cheat sheet of questions Jesus asked, and then I just read those off, and
well played,
it does wonders.
Well played, sir.
Whose face is on that coin?
Yeah.
Ha!
I was asking about euthanasia. Well, just go with it.
Just, yeah.
Just think about the question longer.
So, Trent, you know, you were kind enough to send us your new book that has done exceptionally well, Why We're Catholic. Okay, I'm just, like, really impressed that not only is it's hit not only, like, the Catholic top on Amazon, but it's also hit, like, the top, I think, what was it, 2,000, the top 2,000 books on overall on Amazon?
Yeah, I think at its highest, it was about like number 1,700 or so, which I think is the best selling so far in the Catholic Answers press. So yeah, it's definitely been getting around.
Yeah, I mean, it's phenomenal. And
eat your heart out, Tim Staples.
So I think that, here's the thing, Trent. The way you form arguments is great, but also the way you write is you keep in mind who your audience is, which is, you know, the reason why I think a lot of times you're very successful in not only talking on the radio, but but also in your writing, is because you really are able to put yourself in the position of who your audience is. And that's why I think why Word Catholic is so successful, is because it's, first of all, the title is brilliant, because it's not pushing like why you should be Catholic, it's why we're Catholic. So it's not like overbearing.
Yeah, it's kind of like, title. We're having a party over here, and this is why we're partying.
Right.
You should come party with
come
us.
Come hang out with
yes,
us.
Yes, the cover of the book is a lot of people at a party assembled in the shape of a cross,
yeah.
basically. Yeah. You look at it.
Yeah, exactly. And then not only that, but your chapters, you're so good at being able to take a very big, thick topic and being able to write it in a concise, manageable, chewable way of, you know, it's like 6, maybe 7 pages each chapter. So it's not like you're reading, you know. Okay, I'll tell you, I'll have a confession. When Dave and I first, like, we're really getting into apologetics, and we were really sinking our teeth into a lot of, like, you know, the saints of the church, the doctors of the church. You know, I jumped into immediately, like, you know, I tried to jump into St. Thomas Aquinas and G.K. Chesterton and things, you know, these type of people, where I, as soon as I, like, was opening the book, I realized this is, I'm in over my head. Right, I have no idea what I'm reading.
He still feels that way.
And I still feel that way today as I'm reading the Summa. But no.
I think most people feel that way, myself included. It's very humbling when Thomas says in the Summa Theologica that this is essentially a primer for novices or beginners.
Yeah.
I'm just like, oh, gosh, I can't even imagine what the advanced stuff is.
Right. It's like, oh, St. Thomas, you're so funny.
Yeah.
I didn't know you were a funny guy.
Yeah. but you know, your book, it's concise. It's very readable. It's people can just pick it up, read a chapter. You know, if somebody's wanting to skim through it and have a specific issue with the Catholic Church, or has a specific misunderstanding or thought about the Catholic Church, it's very easy to just pick up, open up to that chapter, and have a concise answer for.
Yeah, and one of the things that you quote, or as I was reading through it, I saw you mention very frequently, happens to be our man gear for today, the Catechism of the Catholic Church. Because it's almost like your book kind of is a warm-up for the Catechism. You know, the Catechism is basically saying why we're Catholic, or what it
means.
Here's
what we believe.
Here's what it means to be Catholic, you know. And so the Catechism is our man gear for today.
Right.
So if you're a dude, you should have a catechism. If you're listening to this podcast, you should have a catechism. If you don't have a catechism, you should be ashamed of yourself, and you should go get one immediately. And I don't want to hear the excuse, I have an app that has a catechism. Yeah. It's like, no.
There's some Catholic guilt for you right there.
There you go. You're welcome. Go get a catechism. I don't know if they make another version, or if it's just one company. Everybody's got, is it Blue? What's the cover? You know, it's like everybody has the same one.
There's one that's printed. The most common one I see is green, but a while back there was a not a pocket version, but a smaller version that was like white. But yeah, it is. There's different publishers who have rights to it. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's good. But the catechism, you know, I'll confess that over the, you know, several years ago, I kind of thought, oh, the catechism is like reading the catechism isn't like reading an encyclopedia. It's not fun. It's not interesting. It's simply a resource material, you know, that you would just refer to get the answer to a question. And I think the reason I thought that is because I had never read anything actually from the catechism. And the catechism is filled with so much beauty. Like some of it is strikingly poetic, the way it speaks about just the beauty of our faith.
Right.
I mean, and I guess that makes sense because the faith is so beautiful. Of course, that's going to translate itself into something that talks about it.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing, Trent, you seem to know the catechism very well. How do you do that? What's up?
Well, it's there's no substitute, really, except for reading it. And while a catechism can seem to be imposing, and it can be if you try to read it in one sitting, I would encourage your listeners that if they just apply themselves to reading 10 paragraphs, it's divided into paragraphs and sections. If they read 10 paragraphs a night, Monday through Friday, in a year, they'll have read the entire catechism. And the paragraphs are not very long. That would take them maybe about 5 or 6 minutes, 10 minutes at the most. But you can probably read 10 paragraphs in about 5 to 10 minutes. And then you learn a lot about our faith in doing that. And I cite the catechism in my books because our goal at Catholic Answers is we're not sharing our opinions about the Catholic Church. We're defending what the Church teaches. And the catechism is a reliable resource to say, here is what the Church teaches. This is what the Church believes. We speak to what the Church speaks to, and we're silent about what the Church is silent on. We might express a private opinion, but we always try to be faithful to the Church's teaching, and the catechism is an invaluable resource for doing that.
Okay, Trent, I have a question about the catechism, and I didn't prep you for this, but I know that you're going to give, I know you've got the answer, because much of what the catechism teaches is infallible. Is it true that not everything in the catechism is infallible? And if that is true, how do we know what is and what isn't?
Well, I don't know if I would use the phrase much of what in the catechism is infallible, if by infallible you mean dogmatic, okay. That the dogmas of our faith are a subset of the doctrines, but there is a difference. That it's correct to say that what is in the catechism, it is an error to say that everything in the catechism is infallibly defined or dogmatically defined. In their introduction to the 1994 catechism, Cardinals Schönborn and Ratzinger, the future Pope Benedict XVI, said that the catechism is not a super dogma, that each of the doctrines that are expressed in the catechism, their weight lies in the individual doctrine. So you will have things in there, let's say the transubstantiation, or Mary being the mother of God, or Christology, the papacy. You'll have elements of our faith that are defined dogmatically and are infallible because they've been taught in the ordinary magisterium, they've been taught universally throughout time and place, or things that have been taught through extraordinary infallibility or through papal infallibility, such as the dogma of the Immaculate Conception or the bodily assumption. But other things you'll find in the catechism are doctrines that are proposed for the faithful to believe, but they have not been dogmatically defined as being divinely revealed and hence infallible. Such as an example I like to give is the catechism says that parents do not create the souls of their children, or that the soul is immediately created from that union. And then there's other examples you can find in there. And then there's other things in the catechism that, you know, there might be citations to things or prudential judgments on matters like the death penalty a Catholic might disagree with, or even things that are errors. In fact, I'm working on a book right now about fake saint quotes, and I think the catechism actually cites one that is not an actual quote.
Yeah. So. That's hilarious.
Whoopsie.
So if you're a guy right now and you're listening and you're thinking like, I don't have a men's group. I don't have a, you know, I don't even know how to start one. Here, let me help you out. First thing you do, grab two guys, two of your friends who are Catholic. Second thing you do, go to Catholic.com or Amazon and buy Why We're Catholic. Read each chapter once a week. Third thing you do, grab a catechism and read through that after you read Why We're Catholic by Trent Horn. When we get back, we're going to talk about arguments. We're going to talk about debate. I'm here with David Niles and Mr. Trent Horn. We're on the Lord's team.
The winning side.
So raise your glass. Welcome back to the Catholic Man Show. We're on the Lord's team, the winning side. So raise your glass. Thanks for hanging in through the break. We are sitting here with Mr. Trent Horn. We're having a rum and coke as our man beverage. Our man gear today was the catechism. I also have to do a little bit of correction. The last segment I said Catholic.com. It should be shop.catholic.com to get Trent Horn's new book, Why We're Catholic. But also, I strongly... Okay, Trent, I promised my wife that I would not, like, do, like, you know, be a fanboy. But when you first joined the Catholic.com and... or Catholic Answers, and I started reading some of your stuff, I made it a rule in my house, in the Minahan house, when Trent Horn publishes something, we buy it. It is in our budget. So, whether that be Answering Atheism, which was probably a book that really helped me because I have a lot of friends and family members who are atheist, but also Persuasive Pro-Life, Hard Sayings, and Why We're Catholic. I can't recommend them enough. So anyway, my wife is going to be embarrassed that I said that, but it is a rule in the Minahan house. And we have your DVDs on your Persuasive Pro-Life and How to Win an Argument, and we have all your stuff. So I can't recommend it enough. Go to shop.catholic.com. Just, you know, in the search bar, just type in Trent Horn and then just buy all of that stuff. That's what you need to do.
You got any problems with that, Trent?
No, I don't. And you can let your listeners know that all the proceeds from the books do go to Feed Hungry Children, my own. So I'm very, very happy to do that. So, yeah, the more we can get the resources out there, that's why I wrote them, to be able to equip people. And I'm always very heartened when I see people reading them or in study groups. And really what I've tried to do, I mean, a lot of this knowledge, it's out there. Catholic scholars and theologians have had it for varying amounts of time, and the area where I'm trying to really fill a void is to take that material and make it accessible for people, make it relatable for them, because if it's out there and it's not accessible or relatable, it's not doing really any good. And then also throwing in my own two bits here and there on some of the topics that haven't been addressed.
Yeah, and I absolutely love your debates. If you go on to youtube.com and just type in Trent Horn debates, there's a lot of debates that you had recently with James White. I think was probably one of your most recent ones.
That was a good one.
That was a great one. So anyway, go check him out. Go to youtube.com and type in Trent Horn debate, and you can find all of his debates there as well. Okay, so Trent, speaking of which, this is a good segue. The main topic today is going to be about debate, forming an argument.
Because dudes love to argue.
Like, as a guy, you... A lot of guys enjoy confrontation, enjoy, you know, sparring back and forth, if you will, verbally, you know, and so, but it's important to know how to set up your, and I think that's why you're so successful, at, you know, at Catholic Answers, is because you've studied, I think, probably Socrates and Aristotle and the Socratic method and being able to formulate your argument, because, you know, even in some of the DVDs that you've talked about, Trent, you've said, it's not necessarily that you need to know the answer, but you need to know how to ask the right question.
Yes, that's really the key. And that's what I try to do with a lot of my work on the radio and in my interactions and even in my books, that I want people to see that if people are investigating our faith or criticizing it or attacking it, they come at it with a set of their own assumptions, even if they're atheists. They have their own set of assumptions about the world, and it's vital for us to challenge those assumptions, both in specific arguments and in the background of the worldview they're promoting, so that we can show that our worldview is superior, true, good, and beautiful. And I find, instead of just saying, you're wrong and here's why, when you ask a question and then they can't answer it, they see the problems in their worldview that they might ignore if you just told them about them.
Very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's absolutely right. And asking questions is really I don't know. I feel like it's one of the only ways you can convince someone of something. If you just sit there and tell someone, they just don't believe you. But it's only when you ask them questions and you kind of make them come to the realization themselves that you can actually move someone into a change of opinion, at least over the course of that conversation. So about your book, you know, earlier I said you're a lot like Jesus in your approach. Jesus also tells stories. One of the things I like about reading your books, Trent, is that you can really get a sense of your personality. It's definitely in your writing, which I really like. And in almost the beginning of almost every chapter, of why we're Catholic starts with a story about you. And, you know, Jesus was a big storyteller, okay? And telling stories has a way also, it seems like, of disarming people, you know, when it's like, oh, well, let me tell you, you know, this happened to me. And it's not like you're making an argument anymore as it is telling a story and you're still making an argument.
You're captivating them.
Yeah. So I think Facebook has destroyed, it's destroyed the art of arguing. It's just, you can't, you know, it's, oh, somebody on Facebook is wrong. Hurry, we have to go shut them down. But what's wrong with everybody, Trent? That's what I'm trying to
ask. Yeah, it's difficult because and that's why I don't participate in a lot of online debates or comment threads on my own social media platform. I don't really allow long threads of debates because that's not what it's for. And I don't find them to be particularly helpful or fruitful to engage in. I mean, sometimes they're helpful to people, but one, they're very impersonal. When you read texts that people write online in Facebook or Twitter or whatever, you almost always interpret it in a very uncharitable way because without the person's facial expressions or tone of voice, written words can just come off very harsh, even if the person doesn't mean them to be.
Yeah.
And a lot of times I'll comment on atheist blogs and I'll try to correct someone on something and then five people jump in and challenge me. And then you cut off one head, two others from this hydra reappear, and you can't answer everybody or people aren't listening. And it just becomes kind of fruitless. So what I try to do, at least with internet comments, yeah, you can't tell a story. I think telling stories is great to help people to see truths about something, which is why I try to use them in a blog post and let people discuss that. On Facebook, even if you're still there, I try just to ask very particular A or B yes or no questions to show the person has a problem in their worldview. And then when they try to escape it, I try to bring them back to that one question, say, you didn't answer my question. And then, you know, and that can be another way of engaging people online.
That's what, this is one of my favorite things about, you know, when you do those, call in if you're pro-choice or, you know, I guess pro-choice is probably, this happens the most. You reach that point in the conversation where you ask them a very dumb question because they've backed themselves into this corner, mm-hmm. and there's an obvious answer, but they won't say it.
Yeah.
They won't say
they
it.
Won't,
yeah.
They won't commit to it.
Those are some of my favorite moments.
Especially when you do the trot out a toddler. You know, that's when it's like, it gets very, you can just almost feel them squirming in their seat.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that comes up a lot because abortion, it's relatively simple to show, look, this is involving human life, and when we get to the core issue, the other side is very indefensible. And I still try to find these very simple questions even for others, and they sometimes get stopped. One that sometimes stops atheists, when they just say flat out, well, there's no good evidence for God, I'll ask them, well, what's the best argument or evidence you've heard, and what's wrong with it? Or what have you read that's a really good defense of the existence of God, and where'd you find a fault? And now I'm in the driver's seat of the conversation. They have a burden of proof to prove they're not just spouting off the top of their head, but then in those moments they can reveal that they're ignorant of the subject they're talking about. And many other subjects too. I try to find a question, get us back to the main issue, and force people on that question to answer it to see, you know, see where it goes.
So last night, Dave and I were sitting on my back porch, and we were having we were smoking our pipe and having a Irish whiskey, and we were talking about we were prepping for this show and several other things because Dave and I also run our local Catholic radio station here in Tulsa, and so we had a lot of things we were going over, and we said that exact thing that you just said when you engage somebody and you ask them, especially an atheist, and you ask them, well, what is the strongest argument for, you know, and this is what St. Thomas Aquinas is so good at. You know, imagine like your position. Now take the other side of that position and come up with the best arguments of that side and then be able to refute it. That's mm-hmm. why I think St. Thomas Aquinas was so successful.
Yeah, and that's important to do because that's the opposite of a common technique you'll find on the internet or among other people who argue against the faith, that they'll take a weaker misrepresentation of our faith and argue against that. And they'll say, oh, well, look at how silly this is. Well, yeah, it's a weaker misrepresentation. That's called straw manning, or mm-hmm. building a straw man position. You know, it's a fake representation of your opponent's view, and it's easy to knock over because it's just a scarecrow, basically. It can't fight back. And people do this all the time. I mean, atheists will say, what you believe, you think everything that exists has a cause, therefore the universe has a cause, and that's God. But that means God has a cause too, so your view is inconsistent. Well, that's a straw man. I've never said everything needs a cause. I only say everything that begins to exist, or everything that does not have to exist needs a cause. So when we engage others, we need to be cognizant of that, of where we're misrepresented, and how to correct people on that.
I totally agree. All right, we're going to take our last break. Time to be right back.
Time is flying.
We're here on the Catholic Man Show with Trent Horn.
We're on the Lord's team.
The winning side.
So raise your glass.
Welcome back to the Catholic Man Show. I'm David Niles, here with Adam Minahan. We are joined, our special guest, Trent Horn. We're talking about arguing, something every man loves to do.
Well, most men.
Yeah.
Some avoid a confrontation at all costs.
That's true. That's true. I shouldn't say every man.
Yeah, that would be fallacious.
I'm going to generalize and say it's something men like to do. So anyway, we were just, Trent, right before the break, you broached the subject of logical fallacies, the straw man fallacy.
Yes.
You know what? The thing about fallacies is that if you want to win an argument with someone, especially on Facebook, you should just use them because they're incredibly effective. Like,
if you're not looking to, like, you know, have a real argument.
Right. No. Yeah. I mean, if you just want the satisfaction of, like, shaming someone, you know, or like, then it's the only way to go. But obviously, as Catholic men, we have to rise above, okay?
Right.
But do you think, I've actually spent a lot of time thinking about this. Do you think the fact that we don't teach logic in school anymore is, like, making people dumb?
Oh, yeah. In fact, there have been several studies recently that show that even when people become non-religious, they don't become more critical or logical as much as atheists would hope that they would. Rather, people who are not religious are more likely to believe in things like UFOs or conspiracy theories or ghosts. So people, just in general, are very bad at critical thinking. They commit all kinds of fallacies or errors in their reasoning. So on the radio, what I try to do when I talk to people and they're thinking about something, I try to see, are they thinking incorrectly about this? Are they making an error in their reasoning? And how can I lovingly point that out to them? And then move the conversation along, basically.
Okay, so let me ask you this. You on air are really good at, you know, pinpointing fallacies. And even you've said some fallacies that I was like, I don't even know what that means. Like, I didn't even know that was a fallacy. I didn't even know, you know, that was a thing.
I like to only use the Latin names for the fallacies because it makes me seem smarter.
Right, it's like quoting St. Thomas Aquinas.
Isn't there a fallacy, like, that says something about saying things in Latin? Maybe that's just a phrase I saw that was in Latin that said, just because you say it in Latin doesn't mean you're right or something. Anyway, sorry.
Probably a popular sentiment, yeah.
Yes.
Right.
But so, it certainly works. Once again, I will say it.
Yes. So my question is to you, Trent, like, in your studies, you know, you're a well-studied guy, but, like, when you were broaching the topic of fallacies, a guy like me who maybe doesn't know a whole lot about fallacies, what do you suggest reading, or what do you suggest, like, turning to be able to pinpoint fallacious arguments?
That, and let me add one to that. What is the most common one you run into?
Oh, well, there are all kinds of fallacies out there. There are formal ones, which are the structure of an argument that something is wrong, or there are informal ones where because human language is ambiguous sometimes, words can have multiple meanings or things like that, you can get these kinds of problems, these errors in thinking. So probably the most common one that I come across, the most common fallacy, I'll put two up. Ad hominem and non sequitur are probably the two most common. Ad hominem is the fallacy of saying X is wrong because person A believes X and person A is bad, or there's something bad about him. So it's just saying, you know, you believe that? Well, Hitler believed in that too. So you, how could you believe that? Or, you know, oh, so-and-so says that this theory is true. Yeah, but they cheat on their wife and they're a hypocrite. The answer to the ad hominem fallacy is to say that nice, sweet people can be wrong and mean, vicious people can be right. For example, some people will say that, well, I'm not pro-life because pro-lifers are hypocrites that only care about babies after they're born. Well, even if that were true, that would not, which it's not, that would not disprove the pro-life argument. It's ad hominem. The other one would be non sequitur, or does not follow. And then that's just one where you have a premise and then a conclusion, but nothing connects them. Like, I'll ask people on air, well, why are you an atheist? Well, you know, I read the Bible and there's all these contradictions in it, and you know, and that's really why I decided to become an atheist. Well, how does it follow that the Bible has a contradiction, that there's no God? At most, you might say, well, God exists, but he allows the Bible to have error, which I don't believe, but that's the most that would follow. Or they're apparent errors, you just don't know how to solve them. So non sequitur, it doesn't follow, there's a gap in the reasoning. Ad hominem would be you're attacking the person rather than the argument they're making.
So the difference between ad hominem is where basically it's name calling. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah, name calling can be a part of it. It's not necessarily ad hominem, because sometimes, and I've done this, I think, in my debate with Raphael Lataster in Sydney. We were debating the existence of God, and he was talking about, well, only a minority of people believe X, to try to discredit one of my arguments. And I pointed out, yes, but Raph, you believe Jesus never existed, and only a tiny number of people believe that. So if you think minority views don't count, you've disqualified yourself. And when Lataster got up, he said it was bad form that I said, well, people shouldn't listen to him because he's a mythicist who denies Jesus existed. And I wasn't calling him a name, like, oh, you're a dumb mythicist. And I wasn't saying people should not believe in him. It would be ad hominem if I said, folks, don't believe Raphael's atheism. I mean, he doesn't even believe Jesus existed. That would kind of be ad hominem. Rather, okay. I'm making a logical comparison. So yeah, merely name calling, like if you say somebody, if I say this atheist is a dishonest, mean-spirited person I would never have lunch with, that's not ad hominem, that's an insult. But if I said God exists because this atheist is dishonest, terrible, and I would never have lunch with him, that would be an ad hominem.
Okay, so I think I get ad hominem and the genetic fallacy confused.
They're similar. They're related. So the genetic fallacy says that a belief is wrong because of the source where it came from. Similar to this, Cardinal John Henry Newman, in one of his replies to a Protestant critic in the 19th century, he accused his critic of poisoning the well of discourse, of, you know, saying like, well, you can't believe what he has to say, Cardinal Newman, because he's a papist and, you know, he's just going to support the Pope. So anything he says is going to be for that. So the idea is you've tried to sow a seed of doubt in the audience to not listen to anything the person says. Their background shouldn't matter. Even if they might have certain motives, their argument stands or falls based on its merit. So the idea that it's like ad hominem, but specifically poisoning the well, talks about a bias or some kind of deficiency in a person making an argument that would, you know, try to invalidate it, basically. If you watch in the James White debate on salvation, you'll notice that as the debate progressed, White would bring up things like that I'm a Catholic who believes in the Assumption of Mary, even right. though that had nothing to do with our topic. But I think that was his way of trying to poison the well so that the Protestants there wouldn't be attracted to my biblical argument, since they were coming from a Catholic.
Right. What a well poisoner.
Yes.
So, Trent, in order to avoid these fallacies, and it's like, personally, I think if you want to keep track of them, get the poster. Okay, there's a poster that has them all.
Right.
Just get it. You put it on your wall. How does one, is there a formula to an argument? I mean, I know that there have been many books written about argumentation back in the day. You know, I mean, a long time ago, back when.
Which was a Wednesday.
It was a Wednesday, if you ask Dane Cook.
Right. He says
back in the day.
Back in the day is a Wednesday.
But is there an easy, simple formula that one can follow to make sure that they're constructing logical, savvy arguments?
Well, I think what's important, sometimes writing out an argument in text and, you know, using even little lines to connect things and asking in a little bubble like, does this follow? Is this true? Does this lead to this? With little, even visual lines can help in building a person's arguments. There is a way people do that in philosophy. You might use like symbolic logic, which only, you know, certain philosophy buffs or professors use. Rather, what you should just try to do in most syllogisms is to say there's a major premise and a minor. And so here are my reasons, and they flow together to form this conclusion. These are the facts. They support the conclusion. And do they? And how do they connect? The best textbook I'd recommend if you want to get really good at arguments and fallacies would be Peter Kraeff's textbook, Socratic Logic. He talks about fallacies and arguments and how to diagram them and how to do this, but he doesn't bog people down with a lot of the technical language. So I'd recommend Socratic Logic by Peter Kraeff. And then you get better at these, and they come up a lot. Another common one is post hoc ergo propter hoc.
That's my favorite one.
Yes. So post hoc ergo propter hoc says is after, therefore, because of. Just because an event happens after something, what it happened after or what came before is not necessarily the cause. And that's just common if you look in history or anything else. Just because something happens before doesn't mean it's the reason that caused it. Just because you step on a crack and later that day your mother breaks her back, the two are not related.
No,
related.
Everybody knows that's why it happened. Okay,
right.
don't deny it, Trent.
Right.
It rhymes. It even rhymes.
Yeah.
Correlation doesn't imply causation.
Right.
So, for example, places with lots of churches also have lots of crime. Therefore, churches cause crime. No, it's correlated. The correlating factor, there's a third factor. Places with high populations tend to have lots of churches and lots of crime. People can mistake correlation for causation.
Okay, Trent, here's a rapid fire session. Marvel or DC?
DC for legendary, awe-inspiring scenes. Marvel for human, enduring characters with problems like us.
Iron Man versus Captain America. Who wins? 3, 2, 1.
I'm going to go with Tony.
Okay, you're on.
We're on the Lord's team.
The winning side.
So raise your glass.
Catholic Man Show.